From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, two state lawmakers want to crack down on illegal marijuana sales. Critics say that's not what people looking to cash in on cannabis need.
What they need is for the state and the legislators to make it easier for them to access the industry.
Also today, a preview of the 123rd running of the Boston Marathon next week. Plus, what's at stake in President Trump's picks for the Federal Reserve, like Herman Cain.
Herman is, you know, he's already sat on one of the Fed boards, and he's just somebody I like a lot.
And how to change the music industry. Ideas from songwriter and producer Linda Perry and Grammy Award winner Imogen Heap.
What you say, oh, that you only meant well.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Legal recreational marijuana stores have been operating in Massachusetts since November. 15 stores have licenses, and yet three-quarters of marijuana sales remain underground. This week, two Worcester-area state lawmakers have proposed a task force to crack down on the illicit market. Stated goals include maximizing tax revenue on the legal stuff and reducing the use of pot among youth. But some worry that this could have grave consequences for people who have been disproportionately affected by marijuana law enforcement. Senator Michael Moore, a Democrat, filed the bill along with his Republican colleague, Representative Hannah Kane. And Senator Moore joins us now from the State House. Hello, Senator.
Hello, Callum. How are you?
I'm well. And we're also joined by Lowry Lucien, a cannabis business consultant and an attorney who teaches marijuana law at Suffolk University Law School. Hi there, Lowry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Senator, I want to start with you. I touched a little bit on what the stated goals of your bill are, but I'm hoping you can elaborate. What's your motive for creating a task force?
Well, when you looked at the referendum that took place and what we think the intent of the voters were, was one, they wanted this product to be regulated. They wanted the revenues that were brought in from it to supplement local aid. And there was a lot of, there was a strong argument being made that by regulating this similar to alcohol, that this would generate a lot of tax revenue. The revenue could be used to help in local aid, funding our schools, and funding programs such as, you know, to help with substance abuse issues and various other issues like that. So we think that if we're seeing a trend where the unregulated sale of this product is increasing and the regulated sale is decreasing or not taking foot, we need to try to address it to try to accomplish the goals that the voters voted for when they put this referendum forward.
And as you envision things progressing, Senator, what would a crackdown on the illicit market look like? I mean, what would the task force do? Are we talking about criminal proceedings here, civil?
No, and I think this is that's why I like to read, instead of calling it black market, illicit market, I really rather refer to it as unregulated, because we're trying to take this out of the criminal realm. This is now a compliance issue. We're creating an administrative process. Because, look, the war on drugs was not successful. The voters have determined they want this to be a legal product, and we need to now accomplish the regulation of it. So by doing that, we've created a separate track. Now, if there is a referral from a law enforcement entity that has done an investigation, it also gives them an option that rather than going the criminal route, they could refer it over to this task force, and this process – and a civil administrative process can be conducted. And then you can look at the revenues. And, there will be an assessment or a penalty established. But right in the law that we're proposing, it states that if they are determined to have violated or the current regulations or laws, that it can't be used against them if they want to continue further to become a legitimate business.
So, Lowry Lucien, what's your take on the senator's proposal here? Mm-hmm. He says it's a civil proceeding. There would be a fine, and somebody who was found to be in violation wouldn't be excluded from getting a license later. Are you comfortable with this proposal?
So I'm looking at the same facts, but I'm looking at another way to attack it. So we're looking at 15 retail stores in the entire state. That makes perfect sense why the unregulated market, which predated the regulated market, would still be operational, because there are geographic locations in Massachusetts where people cannot access cannabis. The problem here is not trying to obtain tax revenue from those who are unregulated right now. The approach should be, how do we remove the barriers that are keeping these individuals from accessing the industry? Everyone who's ever attempted to obtain a license knows how tortuous and how difficult it is to navigate this process without legal fees, without a legal team. Legal fees can cost up to $100,000 to get through this process. You have to have a location. There are so many barriers to entry, which is why even individuals with lots of money are still unable to penetrate, and which is why we only have 15 stores open partially.
So how about that, Senator?
The task force should be focused on education. We have a social equity program that hasn't even been launched yet, that's supposed to provide technical support and access to legal services and things of that sort to enable these individuals to penetrate. But none of that has been provided yet. So I think the focus should be on that first. And if that fails, then let's try to figure out other ways. But we can't relieve these barriers and then go to another level that's a bit of an escalation prior to fixing something that might actually remedy it.
Senator, I think Lowry's speaking for a lot of people's frustrations here, right, that there are only the 15 stores operating. Perhaps lawmakers should put their total focus on making sure that there are more ways for people to obtain marijuana legally, as opposed to cracking down on the people who continue to sell it underground.
Well, I can tell you, in my district, we have the first retail store that opened east of the Mississippi, which was in Leicester. So I saw the direct impact of that on the community and the amount of people that were seeking to purchase this product. And I know in the city of Worcester, they've got 15 licenses that they've got pending. I would love to be able to say, call the Cannabis Control Commission and say, look, issue all these licenses. There's a process. This is a new regulated industry in Massachusetts. We need to ensure that the implementation of this is done correctly. And if it is a little slower than the rollout is a little slower than we thought, then, you know, I wish it could be quicker. But there's got to be some sort of deliberate way that we launch this industry so that make sure that we do it appropriately. Now, as far as the social equity fund that Lori was talking about, we consider this legislation. We actually have three categories where the foregone tax assessment money or penalties will go to. One of it is training for municipal police and state police, so they can be educated on the process, or they can use it for training funds. We have it for youth prevention programs, and we also have it directed towards the social equity fund. So now we actually have a revenue source to fund those very initiatives that she's talking about.
Lowry, if we do end up with a task force, that's handing out fines, I think one thing I'm wondering about, and I'd love to get your take, is who is going to be getting those fines? Because we know that historically, people of color have been disproportionately targeted by law enforcement for possession of marijuana. I mean, for example, in Boston alone, black people made up 66% of marijuana possession cases between 2000 and 2018, even though they're just 22% of the city's population. So I wonder if you're concerned about seeing a parallel there,
right,
with the task force and fines.
Well, Coleman Lowry, can I get a quick question?
I'll come back to you in a moment, Senator. I want to hear Lowry and then get your response.
Clarify something about timing. I understand that the funds will come post any fines being imposed. However, the issue is now. How do we get people into the industry now? The problem is we don't have enough stores because we don't have enough people who are able to apply because they can't afford the process. They can't afford to hold on to a property for 5 months. Let's focus on getting people in now. And if after we've gotten people in and the market is saturated with dispensaries, we're still seeing an unregulated market, then I can entertain an argument about let's impose a task force. But with 15 dispensaries in right now, I think it's a little premature. We should really focus on getting people in.
Go ahead, Senator.
Well, the other thing is, you know, one thing I found in state government or in the legislature too often that we are reactive and rather proactive. So in filing this, it's a method of being proactive in an issue that we may see coming or that we currently have an issue with. As far as it being premature, I'd much rather have this up and running and looking into this issue than really being behind the eight ball and not being able to try to work out the problems. The other thing I wanted to talk about, and where you were talking about people who are negatively impacted by this, mm-hmm. that demographic right now is not included. You're worried about them being prosecuted or them being the recipient of this administrative process. The problem we have right now is that they don't have ownership in a lot of these stores or a lot of these types of businesses. So I don't know where how we would actually be directing or the task force would be directing their enforcement efforts at them if they're not included in the current industry.
Well, presumably they would be going after people who right. don't have the licenses and were selling anyway, right? That they would be continuing to sell.
So you're saying that's the predominant, that predominantly those are the individuals that are in the illegal market?
I don't think go ahead, Larry.
No, I'm trying to understand. We're trying to say that the individuals in the unregulated market are the task force is going to be directed at that. Our issue is that the majority
Correct.
Of the past efforts of enforcement of any kind have always been directed and disproportionately directed towards people who are black and brown descent. So I just want to ensure that is not what we're going to see. There's going to be equal enforcement if this goes through. And I also want to see more of a focus of let's try to include something now in the provisions of getting people access to some type of funds in the meantime as we're waiting for June to come so that individuals can have access to resources to actually penetrate this industry.
Last thing before we go, Senator, I'm curious. We've all been following some good reporting by the Boston Globe on some large businesses that seem to be trying to find ways to get around the Cannabis Control Commission's limit on the number of marijuana shops that they can open. And I'm curious if that's on your radar and if you're contemplating any legislative action in that front.
I haven't been contemplating that, and I wasn't really looking at that. The main issue I had been looking at right now was really the growth of the unregulated market.
Got it. That's Senator Michael Moore, a Democrat who filed the bill along with his Republican colleague, Representative Hannah Kane, to look at a task force on unregulated marijuana use. Senator, thanks for joining us from the State House.
Thank you.
And Larry Lucien, a cannabis business consultant and an attorney who teaches marijuana law at Suffolk University School of Law. Thanks to you as well.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Monday is Patriots Day, which of course means the Boston Marathon. Organizers expect some 30,000 runners from more than 100 countries to take to the 26.2-mile course from Hopkinton to Copley Square. Monday also marks the 6th anniversary of the marathon bombings, which left 3 dead on Boylston Street and injured more than 260 others. It's the first time since the bombing that a marathon has been run on the anniversary. Race organizer Boston Athletic Association just held a news conference this afternoon, and WBUR's Alex Ashlock was there. Hi there, Alex.
Hey, Callum. How you doing?
Excellent. So we can hear the sounds of the conference just wrapping up behind you. What did the BAA announce today in advance of Monday's race?
Well, it did just wrap up. You gave some of the number of runners, the number of countries that will be in the marathon on Monday. One other number, 9,700 volunteers will be along the race course, the 26.2-mile race course from Hopkinton to Boston on Marathon Monday. The big announcement today from the Boston Athletic Association, though, has to do with the 2020 Boston Marathon. They're establishing some new divisions for para-athletes. These are people who are vision impaired, maybe blind runners, people that run on prosthetic legs, or people that have upper limb impairments. There's going to be new classifications and divisions for those athletes next year. There's going to be prize money for them. And this is really one of the big things that the Boston Marathon is doing, looking forward to the next marathon in 2020, taking into account the number of para-athletes who want to compete in marathons as opposed to maybe triathlons or some other event.
Which is so interesting because, of course, we're familiar with the wheelchair division, but those other athletes you're describing have been lumped in with the rest. I want to ask you a bit about the weather, though, too, Alex. I mean, last year,
it was practically anybody's paying attention
to
it?
Yeah, I imagine anybody who ran last year is, right? They were basically caught in a monsoon, and the forecast for Monday doesn't look so great either. So what's the BAA doing to prepare and protect these runners?
You know, it was so bad last year. There were about 2,500 people who needed medical treatment, and many of them were dealing with hypothermia. And there were just a lot of runners who were just cold. They didn't really have any medical issue. They just needed to warm up. And the Boston Athletic Association this year is taking that into account. I've been talking about some of the extra shelter they're going to have on the course. Basically, they're going to have a number of additional buses parked alongside the course, especially at the medical tents that are along the course, and runners will be able to get into those buses and warm up if they need to. It won't be necessarily taking them anywhere. They'll just be able to use those buses as a way to warm up. So those will be parked along the course at places where they haven't been before, just in case the weather is as bad as it was last year. And it looks like it's going to be raining in the morning. It may rain all day, temperatures in the 40s, so it will be a little bit like last year. I didn't think anything could be worse than last year, but it's not looking great for Monday.
Well, you know, the conditions didn't really seem to bother Desiree Linden one bit last year, and she'll be back in the race along with some other returning champions. In fact, 17 returning champions this year. Maybe let's start on the women's side. Who stands out to you? You've got Desiree Linden, who I mentioned, and who else?
Well, you have to talk about Desiree Linden. She was the first American to win the race since 1985. She's always been a tough runner here at Boston, and I expect her to run aggressively again on Monday because she has nothing to lose now. She's won her major marathon, but she'll be up against a very deep international field featuring some past Boston champions like Edna Kiplagat of Kenya. She won in 2017. You also have another Kenyan, Caroline Rotich. She won back in 2015, and even going further back, a 2012 Boston Marathon winner, Sharon Cherop of Kenya. You notice I said Kenya three times there. The Kenyan runners are almost always dominant in the Boston Marathon on both the men and women's side. But there's another American to keep an eye on. Her name is Jordan Hassay. She's only run two or three marathons. She had a great debut here in 2017. She missed the race last year with an injury, but she's very talented, and she's looking to run well on Monday as well.
And how about on the men's side? Who stands out to you, Alex?
Well, you have to talk about Yuki first. He was Yuki Kawauchi. He was the first Japanese winner in the Boston Marathon since 1987 last year. The citizen runner, after he won the race, he had to call his boss at the school he worked in last year to get an extra day off so he could pick up his winner's check the day after the marathon. It would be a real shock, though, if he was able to repeat as Boston Marathon champion. He's not even really the most fat. He's not really the fastest Japanese runner who will be in the race on Monday. And there's also just another deep field of African runners, starting with Joffrey Kiryu. He won the Boston Marathon in 2017. You also have Lemmy Barhanu and Lalisa Desisa. Those runners are from Ethiopia. They're also both past Boston Marathon winners. And there's always somebody who sort of jumps up into the top of the pack who maybe nobody's ever heard of. So I think that'll probably happen again on Monday. But again, I'd be very surprised to see Kawauchi win this race for the second straight year.
And, you know, another former champion we'll see is Meb Keflezighi, the 2014 winner. He'll be the Grand Marshal this year. His victory, of course, was so significant. He was the first American to win in something like three decades, Alex, and he won, of course, the year after the marathon bombing. Yeah. And as I mentioned at the top, this will be the sixth anniversary, first time it falls on the same date. I mean, what do organizers say about the significance of those two things overlapping this time for the first time?
Yeah, Boston Marathon officials are telling me that they're really leaving observances of the anniversary to the city, but I think you can expect the city and the marathon to mark the 2:49 time on the afternoon of Monday. That was the moment the first bomb exploded back on April 15th in 2013. So you can expect some sort of acknowledgement of that. Church bells will likely ring in downtown Boston when that happens. And I think that'll be very significant because there will be thousands of people crossing the finish line at that moment on Monday, just like there were back in 2013. So it's going to be, I think, very special for those runners in particular when that moment passes on Monday. And I think, you know, all runners who participate in the Boston Marathon, they can't help but think about the fact that the bombings happened in 2013 because it's part of the history now. But the race has really come back to be what it was always, and that's a celebration of life and a celebration of people reaching and accomplishing a goal, maybe a lifelong goal. So I think you'll see all those things come together on Monday. It might be happening in the rain, but I think we'll mark the anniversary, but we'll also celebrate the stories that will be told, you know, going forward after we see what happens on Monday.
Right. And we had our own Martha Biebinger reporting today that the state is boosting mental health support for Marathon Day, acknowledging that that anniversary is coming up. Just in the moments we have left, Alex, I mean, you've been covering this race for a couple of decades. How are you reflecting on the anniversary and the race coinciding this year?
Yeah, it's just, you know, in the past, the anniversary sometimes has been a week before the marathon, so it really becomes its own individual event. There's usually a ceremony here on Boylston Street near the sites where both of the bombs went off. They place wreaths, very quiet, very somber, private reflections, moments for people to just think about what happened on that day. But this time it's happening on the same day. So I think, you know, I'll be thinking about what happened in 2013 all day long as I cover the race. But, you know, I'm going to be also focusing on, again, just the things that we see that happen in the marathon, like the history we saw last year with Yuki Kawauchi and Des Linden. There's no way to predict what's going to happen in this 26.2-mile race that's being run for the 123rd time on Monday.
That's WBUR's Alex Ashlock coming to us live from the site of the BAA News Conference at the Fairmount Copley Plaza Hotel. Alex, thanks for your time, and we'll talk to you on Monday.
You're welcome, Callum.
What is going on at the Fed? The central bank will roll back some of the reforms that came in the aftermath of last decade's financial crisis, but recent meeting minutes show that Fed board members are deeply divided over the move. And this comes as President Trump puts forward two polarizing nominees for the Fed's Board of Governors, including pizza mogul and former presidential candidate Herman Cain.
Herman is a wonderful man. He's been a supporter of mine for a long time. He actually ran a very good campaign. And that's up to Herman. Herman is, you know, he's already sat on one of the Fed boards, and he's just somebody I like a lot.
The president, of course, has also been taking swipes at the Fed chairman he picked for raising interest rates. And to discuss all of this, we're joined by Evan Horowitz. He's the director of research communications at FCLT Global, but he's not here to speak for them. He's here as WBUR's business and economy analyst. Evan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Callum, it's great to be here.
Great to have you again. Can you help us break this down? This can be dense stuff. I understand there's a lot going on at the Fed.
No, it's light. It's breezy.
Okay. Well, yeah. You make it light and breezy. Let's start with the interest rates. I mean, just quick background here. Why do they matter? Why should we be paying attention to them? What's going on?
All right. Maybe we just stick with a marathon analogy since that's what we've been talking about. When you're running a marathon, you want to hit the right pace, right? You go too fast, you're going to burn out, too slow, and you're not living up to your potential. So it's the same thing with the economy. You want to keep it at the right pace, and that's really the Federal Reserve's job. If they think the economy is going too fast, they raise interest rates to slow it down. If they think it's not going fast enough, they lower interest rates. So for the last few years, they have been slowly raising interest rates to slow the economy. But there's been a lot of pushback because it's not clear the economy was going too fast.
A lot of pushback from the president, right? And of course, I mean, no president likes to see the interest rates go up, right? I mean, even if it is sort of inflation, you want to have that growth on your watch. But does the president actually have a point?
So the president definitely has a point. And the pushback has been coming not just from the president, but really from across the political spectrum, left, right, and center. There's been a lot of skepticism about the Federal Reserve's moves over time, because usually the evidence that the economy, I mean, the marathon, the evidence that you're going too fast is you're getting more tired than you want to be, you don't think you can make it. In the economy, the evidence is the evidence that you're giving too much stimulus with is inflation. Inflation starts to go up. But we haven't had rising inflation, really. We have barely hit the Fed's 2% target. So the question is, why do they keep raising rates? And if you, you know, I interviewed Fed presidents and they would say, oh, we know inflation is coming. It's just around the corner. But it hasn't materialized. So they were getting a lot of criticism about this from the president, from other people. And then the markets sort of stepped in. When the Fed talked about raising rates and then raised rates last December, the stock market collapsed. And since then, the Fed has really had to backtrack to say like, whoa, we're not going to keep doing this. If this is a big problem, we'll step back. So they're facing a kind of crisis of competence. And part of the pressure is coming from the Oval Office, but it's coming more broadly from the markets. And from left, right, and center.
All right. So as there's this wrangling over the interest rates, the Fed is also pulling back on some of those post-economic crisis regulations that we mentioned at the top. What are those regulations that they're being rolled back? And should we be concerned about it, Evan?
So it's a variety of things. You know, when Congress passed the Dodd-Frank rules after the financial crisis, the whole point was to make sure the banking system was resilient enough so that if we had another problem and one bank got into trouble, the whole system wouldn't come crashing down. There were a lot of tools. You know, you want to make sure banks have enough money. They implemented some stress tests. And the Fed was charged with making sure that – with implementing a lot of these things, you know, getting the details right. And at first, they were pretty strict. And the last few years, there's been a press from Congress and beyond to kind of loosen some of these rules. So they've been gradually loosening some of the requirements on banks so they don't have to submit their plans as often, so they don't – the stress tests aren't as severe. And there are concerns that this makes the economy more vulnerable. My concerns are limited in the sense that I feel like very often regulators are trying to fight the last war, the war that they just lost and that hangs heavy over their souls. And in this case, they're desperately trying to avoid another financial crisis that looks like that one. But odds are the next crisis ain't going to look like that one. It's going to be something different. And I think we should be thinking more broadly about where the risks are.
All right. And the composition of the Fed board might look different going forward as well with these two nominees. I mentioned Herman Cain, the former presidential candidate, up the top. There's also Stephen Moore, who has been sort of an informal economic advisor. We hear his voice a lot on NPR, breaking down, get some insights into the president's economic thinking. Fill us in a little bit more on who these people are and their qualifications for the job.
Sure. I mean, this actually gets back to the question you asked before, which I answered in a slightly different way, about the pressure that comes to the president. Don't all presidents really want the Fed to lower interest rates so they get a faster economy while they're there? Like, imagine the marathon's tough, but like, it would just try to stick with the analogy. Imagine if like you had a real interest in making sure some runner did his best at like mile 20. And that's the presidential election. Like, from Trump's perspective, he doesn't really care all that much, maybe he does, that the economy is doing great in 2026 or 2028. He cares about 2020, right? And presidents care about the next election. So they might say, hey, wouldn't it be great if we lowered interest rates now or right in advance of the election? That way things look really good when I'm up for re-election, and that boosts my chances, right? So this is the concern, and this is the context for thinking about Herman Cain and Stephen Moore.
Because, who might be more likely to do his bidding, in other words, if they were on the board.
I think this is the concern, right? Because they're not economists. You know, they don't have expertise in monetary policy. That's not how they got picked. And it's not a right-left thing. There are experts on the right in monetary policy at the Cato Institute, at George Mason, in a variety of places. And several of them have come out and said, Herman Cain and Stephen Moore are not qualified. Or their qualifications amount to loyalism. I mean, you can take them individually. Herman Cain, it's true, and you played it in the clip. He did sit on the chair of one of the regional Fed boards. But you got to understand what that position is. He wasn't president of the regional Fed board. Like, the president of the regional Fed board, the president of the New York Fed, the president of San Francisco Fed, like, they make policy decisions. The chairman of the board tends to be a kind of local business bigwig in a sinecure. And that was Herman Cain's job. He was a very successful businessman, but he was not involved in monetary policy. Stephen Moore is a pundit. That's why you said you hear him on NPR. He is a pundit. He's a very good pundit. You know, he has interesting things to say. But he also wrote a book called Trumponomics about how to use an America First approach to sort of redeem the American economy. He's very much a Trumpist. And his views on monetary policy seem to have shifted in very partisan ways. That is, when Democrats were in power, he was a high interest rate type. He thought the Fed was overstimulating the economy, even though we had just gone through a recession and needed it. Now he seems to be a low interest rate type. He wants to lower them, even though the economy is actually pretty good. And that kind of partisan flip-flopping suggests something other than the temperament of stability that people generally look for Fed board governors.
Okay, but the experts, the people who are the trained economists you're describing, can be fallible too, right? And I would point to former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan, right, who was the prototypical expert. But under his stewardship, the Fed did allow financial firms to trade in securities backed by subprime mortgages. And, you know, Greenspan and other experts are arguably responsible for the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. So maybe the Fed could actually use some unusual leadership, Evan.
So I totally agree. Desperately fallible, even the experts that we put on the Fed. And this, I think it's the conjunction of these two crises, like the crisis of competence, the one that I was talking about at first, where the Fed was raising rates. We don't know why. They seem to be making these decisions that are contested all across the political spectrum. People don't understand why they're making decisions. And then the crisis of independence. Well, the Fed's supposed to be an independent body making the best decisions for the entire marathon, not for just how we're running an election year or whatever it is. These are coming together at a very dangerous point for the Fed, because the fact that you even asked this question, right, suggests we have maybe lost enough faith in the independence of the Fed, in the credibility of the Fed, to try out some radical solutions, to maybe vet and accept some non-traditional candidates with potentially very unpredictable outcomes on the long-term economic health of the country.
I think you're hitting on sort of two parallel themes right there. There's the actual qualification, and there's also the optics, which are important as well, the public trust component. Evan Horowitz is a business and economy analyst for WBUR. He's also director of research and communications for FCLT Global. Evan, thanks as always for your time.
Callum, it's a great pleasure to talk about marathons and the Federal Reserve.
Made for each other. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Remember this song?
What you say? That you only meant well, 'cause you did.
That's Hide and Seek by Grammy Award-winning artist, producer, and engineer Imogen Heap. Heap's music has left an indelible stamp on popular culture and on a generation of artists like Jason Derulo. Now, what about this one? That's Four Non Blondes' What's Up and lead singer Linda Perry. Perry is an artist, producer, engineer, and a member of the Songwriter Hall of Fame. She's a Massachusetts native with a career working with artists like Christina Aguilera, Alicia Keys, and Pink. This year, Perry was the first woman in more than a decade to be nominated for Producer of the Year, Non-Classical, at the Grammys. Perry and Heap are both working to change how the music industry treats artists, and they've got two different and bold ideas. Both women are in Boston today to speak at Berklee College of Music, but first they stopped by for a conversation in our studio, and Heap began by reflecting on what she sees as the biggest problems in the industry.
Well, essentially, we have an industry which is very fragmented, and each part of that industry is very interested in itself. It's interested in the data that it has, it's interested in holding power. And along the kind of the play-to-pay situation between the music maker and the, you know, that which has played it, or whether it's radio, whether it's a streaming service, whether it's a live performance, the long process that it takes to reach the payment of that music maker is sometimes 2 years. And there's lots of people along the way who take, you know, a chunk out of that. And as that happens, data gets lost through that process. So the biggest problem, perhaps, is just trying to massage the music industry to a place where we see ourselves as a holistic organism rather than separate entities, you know, trying to reach higher profits. And so we are now, you'll see so many music makers starting to develop their own services, their own apps, coming into the music industry as a kind of force from the ground force of those at the coalface, developing projects, developing services that they know make sense. And that's, we're seeing a big shift there.
I want to dive into those music business models in a little bit. But Linda, I also want to ask you about the music itself, because you recently told WBUR's Ariel Gray that you think there are a lot of hits being made right now, but not enough art being made. What do you mean by that, and what's causing it?
Well, I feel that what's happening is the art of music is getting lost, the art of recording, you know, the art of songwriting. It's coming from someone, you know, that sits at a piano or picks up a guitar. Like, I actually sit and, you know, I guess I would be considered old-fashioned. How dare I? Wow, you're so old-fashioned writing a song like that. But I do believe in that style of writing songs, man. I mean, I believe that it comes from your heart and you sit and you express a story. And I believe it's that story that's being missed, and that's why, honestly, for me, I feel the music industry is, you know, collapsing, is because the experience that we give to the listener is being taken away by this very, you know, cut and paste, just want to get on the radio kind of mentality. That is where, you know, Imogen and my story come together and meet.
To your point about being maybe old-fashioned, though, in the way you conceive the song, I don't know if it's old-fashioned, but what about sort of just being kind of, I don't know, a highbrow? I mean, if it's popular and it's a hit, you know, isn't there sort of an inherent art in making something that's just popular for mass consumption?
Go ahead.
I think it's a bit like a fear of, oh, if I don't make something popular, then I'm going to fail and then I'm going to be penniless. And it's so hard to get into that position of actually having any success, that when you get there, it doesn't leave you with this support. There really is this kind of this sense of, oh, it could topple at any moment. And that's not a good way to kind of wake up in the morning and feel relaxed about, you know, wanting to drift into finding something core and emotional that you want to express.
Sure.
And also, fear is a terrible place to operate anything, you know, based on fear, because I'm not saying I'm highbrow at all. Trust me. I mean, I believe in, like we were talking about Grimes. I think she does incredible art, you know, with her knowledge and her technology and her creative. We're talking about kind of the mainstream, you know, place where people are operating from. And it's operating from, what did they do? I want to copy that, you know, and labels putting out a song every week. We have to ask ourselves, who are going to be our legacy artists? Who are going to be our Aretha Franklins? Is it going to be Justin Bieber? Is that going to be our Marvin Gaye? Because if that is, I'm not saying anything about him at all, but I'm saying that's just not good enough. We have to raise the bar. Zeppelin and Smokey Robinson and Carole King and Janis Joplin, still in 2019, why are kids still listening to that music? Because they hear a difference. Some of them think Zeppelin's a new friggin' band. You know, I remember hearing a kid going, this song, Hotel California, that is a great song. Is that a new band? Why are kids doing that?
Well, so they're still listening, and they're sampling, and they're riffing on
exactly
it, new music.
That's all I'm trying to talk about.
Yeah.
That is quality stuff.
Well, and Imogen,
I'm just trying to figure out who is the quality right now.
Who's the quality? And Imogen, you've seen a lot of artists do this with your work as well, right? To riff on it, sample it, and whatnot. And I wanted to ask you about one sort of really high-profile episode involving Ariana Grande, who has talked glowingly about the influence of your work on hers. And you talked to Vulture last year about when you were miscredited on one of her songs. This was her cover of Good Night and Go on her album Sweetener. Let's just take a listen to both songs, yours and then hers.
Okay.
Why'd you have to be so cute? It's impossible to ignore you. What must you make me laugh so much? Is that enough? We get along so well.
So I understand that she had permission to use Goodnight and Go, right? She'd spoken with you about this before, but then you weren't credited on Spotify or in the album artwork for the cover of that version. So how does that happen? And is that part of what you're trying to address with your Creative Passport project?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, Ariana, she's a huge fan. She's been a huge fan for years and, you know, have this really sweet relationship. And I was so excited when she sent me the cover of, well, she's not, it is a cover, but it's also, she's got a new verse and it's very, very different. So, yeah, I was shocked. I was like, wow, that's, how could that happen? You know, loads of my fans were angry at Ariana for not, you know, not crediting me. And I was like, God, if Ariana knew that, never in a million years would she have let that go. But she's extremely busy. She's got, you know, a major label dealing with that stuff for her. And it should be taken care of and it should be done properly. But for whatever reason, it wasn't. And there weren't the right people overseeing it. And the problem is that in order to kind of make that right, I had to call up my ex-manager, who then had to call up their manager, who then had to call up the label, who then had to do the staff and da-da-da. And it took maybe 2 weeks of time to get that changed on Spotify. It couldn't be changed on the main artwork. And it's an insane amount of waste of time and money. So the idea of the Creative Passport is really, it's to create a verified identity space, a digital identity space at its kind of core level for music makers. So that we can be verified to suggest a change, to augment some metadata around a track independently ourselves on our own merits without having to go permission, da-da-da-da-da thing happening. We could do that in, you know, 5 seconds.
So what you're describing here is this big sort of music database powered by blockchain technology, which is the same underlying technology for Bitcoin. I usually think about it in sort of the banking industry, right, that you can have super fast, super secure transactions. How do you do it? How do you pull it off, though, for music? I mean, do you need to get individual buy-in from Spotify and all these? Does everybody have to be participating?
Yeah, so it's been evolving ever since I kind of went, oh, blockchain, amazing thing. Let's think about what that can do for the music industry. And essentially, it can't do anything on its own. It needs the right applications. It needs the right people to buy into it, as you say. And over the years, it's kind of boiled down to actually the Creative Passport being very small. It's a very tiny, thin bit of data, but it's a very essential piece of data. It's the bit that points everyone to this one point of view. So when you go onto Spotify and you're looking up the credits, and if you're lucky enough to be credited up there, you know, if you are lucky enough to be there, you could imagine the next point not just being Imogen Heap, you know, end of story on Spotify, you know, just a no link. You could click on further to that and discover Imogen Heap endpoint in the world, like the digital version of me. How can we empower our digital selves to be working on our behalf 24/7, interfacing with machines and humans? When they need the data, we can give it to them, but we can't do that as an individual. We just don't have the time or the money or the team. So we need to live in that digital space. So that's essentially what this is. We're not a threat to anyone. We're actually going to help alleviate a lot of the friction. We're going to help the flow much better. We're going to help labels, we're going to help collection societies with their missing data sets and be able to be more than the sum of our parts, because at the moment we are just parts, and the only tissue that connects everything are the songs and the musicians, and we need to empower that connection.
We're talking about the music industry with Grammy winner Imogen Heap and Grammy nominated producer Linda Perry. And Linda, I want to ask you about your We Are Here, H-E-A-R, label, which sort of has some overlap with the artist empowerment mission that Imogen is describing.
Yes.
How are you going about that?
Well, again, we are such the polar opposites. I'm more in the old school mentality of developing and finding, you know, the one piece that Imogen is talking about, and that's the artist. In the 90s, when I was an artist and with Four Non Blondes, I remember as being in rehearsal rooms and oh, my amp blew up, and I would go down and there would be, you know, Primus or Helmet or, you know, Green Day, and we'd, you know, share instruments, we'd get up on stage, we would communicate together and collaborate and be creative and fun. And you don't see that at all anymore. Like, that's what I'm talking about. It's like you're just seeing labels finding something that kind of fits what's happening right now, and they throw it out there. So what we're doing is we're trying to build a community and we have a vinyl pressing plant, you know, where you can get up on stage and play right to vinyl. We have a store to sell that vinyl for kids to come and meet other kids. We have songwriter showcases. So we are here is basically a very old school mentality with a very new school way of distributing music. And we're just left field. Like we're not waiting for license, you know, for ad agencies to come to us. We go to them, bring our artists to them, play, and we've been getting licenses from that. I get on the phone and I call radio stations. Now, mind you, the same radio stations that aren't paying our artists, and, you know, I still do believe in radio, but I call them myself and they're like, what? You know, why are you calling Linda Perry? And I'm like, it's my artist. Of course I'm going to call, you know, so it's really developing relationships that can help create a personality behind the music.
Interesting. The two of you will be on a panel at Berkeley this afternoon, and you'll be talking about, at least in part, a new report from Berkeley that struck me as really interesting. They took a survey and found that 78% of women in the music industry report that they have been treated differently because of their gender. Nearly half of the respondents said that they should be farther along in their careers. What's your takeaway from that?
It's a very different landscape than when it was. It was a very studio-based environment where it was men only. You know, when I went and made records from the age of like 17 in recording studios, I never saw women, ever. Not even a tea girl. You know, it was just not a thing. There was one engineer I work with called Avril McIntosh. She's amazing. But that's the only person. I did come across times where I was put in, you know, very awkward situations, and I had to deal with them in ways that were very uncomfortable. And to be honest, it was so the way that it was done, and maybe it still is, that I didn't even realise that it was happening. I didn't even realise that wasn't, you know, should be different, could be different. But I didn't actually realise until I was in a place called Portcullis House in London, which is where you meet MPs and you discuss these things. And my friend Vanessa Reed, she's the head of the PRS Foundation. And she pulled loads of women together and she said, Imogen, I want you to come and talk about women in the music industry and what it's like and how hard it's been. And I'm like, do you know what? I haven't found it hard. And then I was in that meeting and all of these women were talking about experiences that they'd had. And I started to cry. I was like, that was me, that was me, that was me. But I just wasn't aware of it. It was so prevalent. It was so everywhere. So I think, you know, the really important thing it comes back to community. And with social media, we are seeing that kind of more openness. But what we don't have still is that kind of private conversation space in a controlled space where we don't have to blurt out everything in public, but we can interface with each other in the digital space. We need to reach out to each other, to support each other, to knowledge share, to signpost good and bad actors, and become this kind of, you know, policing our own space in a way that is useful to us to move into the future.
I'm angry at the fact that women have to go like 10, 15 more miles than men do. And also the thing is, too, is that the information hasn't been out there. Like when you're saying long time ago, it's not sexy. When you think about a producer, engineer, honestly, most people, kids are thinking, oh, they're old and it's uncool. So that's why I started this We Are Now. And, you know, I had Dolly Parton, Sheryl Crow and Grimes and myself in a studio talking about our favorite, you know, drum techniques or why Dolly doesn't care to have credit for production, but she does all the production, you know, and how Grimes does everything in the box. So it really is showing the fans that are, you know, Grimes, the younger generation, oh, that's cool. So basically, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to show that there are other avenues besides just being the girl on stage dancing around, that you can be empowered, you can still be creative, and it's sexy in a different way. And then I'm not talking about sexy, I'm talking about swagger sexy. I'm, you know, just an other environment you can plop yourself into, and it could be very, very creative.
Interesting. And Imogen, I know that in just about a week on April 19th, we're going to have some new music from you, which we haven't heard yet, but you're releasing it on Linda's label, We Are Here. What can you tell us about what we can expect?
So I was in a band once upon a time called Frou Frou, and we released a record called Details, but we never really had the chance to tour it because the label didn't support us when we wanted them to. Mm-hmm. They supported the more famous band. And so we now get the chance to tour together. We're touring now. We're going to be touring. We're going to be here in Boston. I'm also doing Boston Calling. But one song that we've written that we really, really love is called Guitar Song, and we're releasing it with We Are Here, and we're very excited. So that's going to be the kind
of... It's stunning. It's a beautiful song.
The A side, in inverted commas. And then on the other side is this song called The Quiet, which is a track that I initially wrote for a game. But it's a very sweet song. It's very orchestral. And hopefully, you know, some people will hear it and like it. And I'm very happy with the song.
That's Imogen Heap, a Grammy Award-winning artist, producer, and engineer, and she's in Boston for a 3-day artist in residency at the Berklee College of Music. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Linda Perry, Grammy-nominated producer, artist, engineer, and member of the Songwriter Hall of Fame. Linda, thanks for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And we'll go out today on an instrumental version of Imogen Heap's 2015 song, Tiny Human. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Paris Alston, Chris Sidorick, Eve Zuckoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.